Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's Sunday, January 19th, 2014, and welcome to episode 66 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is the podcast about retro computing news, nostalgia, and collecting, made by retro computing users for retro computing users named Earl. Yes, if you're not named Earl, please turn off now. Oh, speaking of which, one of the many people on this show, oh, brace yourself, dear listener, we have a bunch of them. One of the many people on the show today with me is the usual fellow, Earl Evans. Earl, welcome to the show.
Yes, I'm a usual unusual. Hello, Carrington.
Hello. How are things in Earl Land?
Things are great. Well, they're kind of great. We'll talk about the chess match later.
Oh, the chess match. The wonderful chess match. I can't wait to talk about it. So, also joining us is what some of our listeners might think is the new guy to the show, but no more, dear listener. No. Paul is now an old hand. We have Paul Hagstrom. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hello. Thank you.
A veritable veteran at this point.
Yes, he is. And how are you doing today, Paul?
I'm doing fine. Happy to pass the grudge work down to the new guys.
Yes. And speaking of which, it is time for us to finally branch out into new accents. I will no longer be the person on the show with the oddest accent to you Americans. Nope, we are delighted. Well, I don't know about the other guys, but I am delighted to welcome to the show for the first time Michael Mulhern. Is it pronounced Mulhern, Michael?
You got it perfect.
Well done me, mate. How are you? And welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me along.
Now, where are you with that crazy accent?
Oh, I'm in a lovely little suburb, rural area called Kenthurst, which is in the northwest of Sydney. And I'm actually in the middle, or just starting moving from suburbia, from a 500 square meter block, up to acreage, 21,000 square meters.
That is a big upgrade.
Yeah, for my North American colleagues, that's roughly five and a smidge acres.
A smidge, a metric smidge. Now, most of us on the show have we lean toward a particular 8-bit computer as the one we love. I am somewhat notorious with my Apple II bias. Earl, foolishly, is a Commodore guy. Paul joins me in the wonders of the Apple. And what about you, Michael? What do you have a particular 8-bit micro that...
Well, I'd have to pull you up there, Karen. I've never noticed a bias.
Oh, so you're an Apple guy then?
Yeah, Apple II. I still have my original Apple IIc that I bought back in 84 when it first came out.
So you still have that actual one?
I still have that actual machine.
Nice.
The little 9-inch monitor that came with it. And I was feeling rich about 12 months later, and I bought the 3.5-inch drive for it as well.
My goodness, that is very tricked out.
It is a very tricked out Apple II, and 2C, and it still works. And I've just been recently using ADT Pro to recover or image as many floppy disks as I can.
Fantastic. Now, do you have experience with other 8-bit computers as well? Any other retro computers in your past?
I haven't owned or really played with anything else. I do use other retro computers. There's the Macintosh. I think they're fairly popular these days.
Yes, I've heard of them.
Yep. But apart from that, it's really just been the Apple II. And to earn a crust, I basically work on Linux and AIX systems as a legacy data stream support person.
Well, fantastic. Now, for our listeners' enjoyment. I am so happy that we have not one, but two people with hints of Aussie in their voice, because sitting silently until now is yet another person to step up to the mic. Can we have Miles Wakeham? Welcome to the show.
How you doing?
Now, so what about you? What is? Give us a brief history of your 8-bit experience, and do you lean towards one particular brand?
Well, I'm going to sound like the old guy here, and that's one of the first times in my life I think I've ever said that.
It's oscilloscopes, isn't it? You're just into oscilloscopes.
No, I guess my first computer was a TRS-80 Model 1 back in 1978.
Well, about time we got a TRS-80 guy on here.
Yeah, and I've kind of followed that path for a number of years until I too branched into the Apple world, but I also branched into many other worlds, and so I've dabbled and danced around the world of personal computers since the dawn of time.
Now, to my ear, I hear a strong Aussie twang. Now, but you're not actually in Australia at the moment, are you?
No. For the last 20 years, I've lived in the United States. I'm in Arizona.
20 years, and you still haven't shaken your accent.
Yeah, funny about that.
Well, I am very pleased that everybody's joining us today. So there are five of us, and I think Earl was saying off air just before we got on that this may be actually a record for the show. So that's quite exciting. I'm very, very pleased about that. And I'm going to be celebrating with one of our weirder host topics. As recent listeners to the show will know, each week one of us gets to play host. Today, it luckily gets to be me. And so I get to inflict upon you people an idea, a thought experiment, if you were. And I am titling this one, The Way We Weren't. See, things didn't always have to be how they are. So I want, if you can, think of something that happened, a turning point. Maybe it was a software development, a hardware release. Maybe it was a business decision, a buyout, or whatever. Throughout the history of vintage computers, of course, there's been many of those, and they all resonated. They had effects. They turned us into the computer landscape we have today. But imagine if one of them didn't happen or went differently, how that might have affected it. We don't have to go into a lot of details, obviously, but do you have any ideas of something that was maybe a major event that did have resonance, and you can talk about sort of maybe something that came as a result of that, or maybe one idea of one thing that might potentially be different if that hadn't happened that way. So does anybody want to step up to the microphone and be the first person to dive into this very strange topic?
Yeah. One of the things that was interesting to me in the mid-80s was the 16-bit computers that came out from Commodore and from Atari, the Atari ST and the Commodore Amiga. And function-wise, they were really pretty much on par with their Macintosh contemporaries, but nobody took them seriously because they were from computer companies that at that point were a little bit more obscure, especially in a business context. And the IBM PC had already made some inroads, and so while you've got IBM and Apple fighting for the business world, there wasn't a lot of room, especially in big business, for other contenders. I wonder what would have been different if one of those two companies had been taken more seriously in the business context, if software developers had jumped on board and written some really high-quality business software for those machines, especially Commodore in the light that they actually targeted in the early to mid-80s to try to break into the business world. It was unsuccessful. Their marketing and their approach just didn't get them in the door. But what if they had? I wonder how things would have turned out.
I know that when I was thinking about this for a while, one of the things that seemed to keep coming back to me is that for any given thing, I'm kind of wondering if we would have sort of wound up where we were, where we are anyway. The brand names might be different, and it might have taken a little longer, or maybe something would have come a little sooner. But for questions like, would there be kind of an overarching software suite, you know, if there wasn't a Microsoft? And my guess is that there would be, just maybe not from them. Mm. And it's possible that I'm just brainwashed in some way, but it seems like there's a trajectory that's fairly inevitable. You know, smaller, faster, bigger storage, friendlier. But if somebody hadn't invented Windows, I think somebody else would have.
So from an evolutionary standpoint, you think that the situation would have been similar, maybe a little bit different, but pretty similar to what it is today.
I guess that's when I was thinking through this, it seemed like it was mostly about timing, and possibly, you know, how pretty things are. But, you know, if there wasn't a Mac OS, or if Apple had disintegrated when it was almost going to, would we not have something quite similar now? It seems like when thinking about things like, you know, would we use mice?
Like actual mice?
Yeah. Right. It seems to me like, considering the other options, it almost had to go that way for the time, without possibilities of accurate enough touchscreens and with all the sort of desk real estate that a tablet would take in order to get resolution good enough to work with. So I wonder, you know, how much of this is almost predetermined.
Well, I've got to add one in here. I'm going to go back in time even further than that. I'm going to say one of the pivotal moments in the personal computer revolution would have been the Bill Gates letter to hobbyists at the Homebrew Computer Club, which I'm not sure if you're all aware of, but it's pretty much a standard in history that at this point in time, there was a big issue regarding the freedom of giving software away for free, where software was considered a commodity that no one really cared about. They were more interested in hacking the hardware and building the hardware up. And then in steps this young guy, Bill Gates, who basically read the Riot Act to these guys and told them that they need to start paying for software. I wonder if that letter had never been written, if somebody like him had never stood up, what the world would look like today.
Oh, good one. Absolutely. Because that had a lot of resonance and a lot of effect for a long time. So that could have drastically changed sort of the financial position and changed the whole way things were retailed. Good one.
And I'm willing to accept that that might actually have changed the course fairly dramatically with sort of different funding, different people funding research and development.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that about, you know, it wasn't that long after that time that a lot of people out of academia started getting into this whole free software movement, and that sort of thing started to become apparent. So if there had been a time delay until that period had happened, I wonder what the world would look like today.
Do any of us know when Stallman started the Free Software Foundation and when that movement got started? Because that was extremely instrumental in the free and open software world. And I wonder if that was kind of contemporaneous with the stuff that was going on at Homebrew and Bill Gates' letter and that.
I believe it was 83.
Yeah, and it was early 80s.
Yeah, I'm only saying that because I was actually running a software company back in those days, and we actually received in the mail a whole bunch of the original GNU disks with all of his software well before there was anything like Linux. You know, we were receiving his C compilers and things like that.
Mm. It looks like that was actually 83, but technically the Free Software Foundation was October 1985, so it wasn't until 2 years later. But the GNU stuff was absolutely all announced and implemented in 83.
So rather than kind of a parallel movement, it might have been a reaction to the increasing proprietary nature of software.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, Michael, what about you? Do you have an idea, something to chime in of how things could have gone differently?
Okay, well, seeing that Bill Gates is pretty much the man of the moment on this chat, I was looking at Windows 3.1, which for me was when Windows actually became a useful operating system, well, still DOS shell for all of those, but it actually made the Windows useful. I'd been using Windows 2 prior to that, and that was a real pain. But Windows 3.1 is when they got all their mess together. It was useful, and I kind of figured that if Windows 3.1 hadn't really caught on, maybe that would have invigorated the competing operating systems, and we wouldn't have the homogenous operating system that we have today in Windows, but maybe greater proportion of alternate operating systems competing against Windows and the Mac OS and Linux, the Amigas and whatnot that that died out. Maybe they would have had that extra breathing space to make for a much more populated PC environment.
It would have been nice. I always wondered how much of that was based on the operating system being prevalent and how much of it was just based on proprietary file formats. Like everyone used Office, so everyone used Office, and therefore everyone used Office, except me, it seems. The world of Windows. But I completely agree with you that it was 3.1 was basically the first time I started using it and the first time it seemed like a real fleshed-out, usable operating system. It was a major leap forward.
Yeah, well, I'd played with Windows 1. I actually was using a demonstration evaluation copy of Windows 1 on 5 1/4-inch disks, and it was interesting and didn't catch my attention at all. Started using Windows 2 with some scanning software, and that was a real pain to keep it all running. Not that running a lot of hardware under Windows is easy these days anyway, but maybe that's where it started. But yeah, Windows 3.1 and then 3.11 for workgroups was really where there was something that you could use, and it really just at that point exploded into the business world.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. So for me, I had put a couple in the show notes, but I think what I'm going to choose is something a little later, because we've gone early, so I'll go later, and something that kind of broke my heart at the time. I loved what Apple was dabbling in with the whole OpenDoc idea, and I remember playing with CyberDog, and the idea of instead of big monolithic pieces of software, instead of getting a word processor that has all of the word processing bits, you instead would have little templates, little basics. And if you start with a word processor and you want to add a different little element to it, you wanted a different spell checker, you would just take your spell checker and drag it over. And applications were like what we have today on iOS and Android, little tiny apps, often single-purpose ones, but that could click together. And so you wouldn't have single companies running and owning whole industries. You would have lots of little ones sort of feeding. And actually, maybe it never could have happened, but I loved it. I loved playing with it. I thought it was really exciting. And it died a terrible death. It just crashed and burned and went nowhere. And I see hints of it today in mobile and the idea of apps and less expensive things and things click together. And I always thought it would have been very interesting if that had really taken off, and alas, it didn't go anywhere. But I think we'd have a slightly different, maybe, software landscape on the desktop than we do today if that idea had gotten hold. But now, did anybody else here actually ever use any of that stuff?
Well, I never used it. I heard Bill Gates talk on it. It was interesting. He did a whole talk on how we would have document-centric computing rather than application-centric computing. You'd have a document. Within that document would be various pieces of data that might be acted on by a wide array of software widgets. So you wouldn't necessarily have a word processor and a spreadsheet and a database and this and that and the other thing. You'd have a document, and within that document would be different. They'd be acted on with different widgets that would come up. And it sounded like a great idea, and it went absolutely nowhere. And I still wonder to this day why that went nowhere, because it seemed like a much more modular and extensible approach than the giant monolithic productivity suites that we have today.
Yeah, but I wonder how much the people that were currently making all their money off software, none of them would have had a vested interest in the idea of let's tear down that system.
Maybe the big players wouldn't, but the little players who could have made little widgets that would have acted on this and that would have had a big stake in this.
Yeah.
Because that way they wouldn't have been edged out of the market.
So perhaps, who knows? But for me, that is the thing, the time I got really excited about sort of a direction. I could see an industry going in, and I got really on board and really didn't contribute. I was just saying rah, rah, rah from the sidelines. And so maybe I was part of the problem, but it died, went nowhere. And alas, big software is here to stay. So any final thoughts? Anybody have anything else to throw in to contribute, little short ideas before we move on to the news?
Well, I was just going to say, I think the death of OpenDoc is the subject of a fairly widely viewed Steve Jobs video, if I recall correctly. There was a WWDC where I think he was basically announcing it was over and getting heckled by the audience. I'll try to find a link for it. But
be fantastic. I'd love to watch it, and then we can put a link into the show notes for people who, like me, are still sad about it. I just won't let it go. So let's go on to the news. In fact, Paul, you're still on the spot, because it looks like our first bit is coming from you, and it's the search for the lost Cray supercomputer OS. I said that all with one breath.
Very nice. Yes. Okay, so the Cray, you know, the Cray computer company is sort of famous for having produced these supercomputers in the late 70s, I guess. And there was recently an article on GigaOm, talking about sort of a couple of different efforts to kind of recreate the Cray 1. And so a while back, this is primarily sort of about two different people who are working on it, Chris Fenton and Andras Tantosh. Yes, Andras. He says his name in the video.
Okay. It's easy for you to say.
But at any rate, Chris Fenton had a little while back actually built a very small scale model. I forget what it is. It fits on a desk. It's about the
1/10 scale, I think.
Well, that's not fun. The fun of the Cray is that huge bench, like the computer as lovely furniture.
Oh, well, but you can put your action figures on the 1/10.
I guess that's okay.
It is a beautiful little model. He sort of built it out of wood and painted it, and you know, it looks very nice. But one of the problems was that having built this thing, there's no software. And so this article that we'll link to has a documentation of the effort to try to locate some software for this. And of course, this is a computer that was sold for, you know, millions of dollars, right? To big companies who have very specialized needs and secretive needs. So a lot of this data, the operating system portion of it is not easy to find. The article goes through how they found somebody who had a diagnostic disk pack and going through and, you know, trying to get the data off of it. A later disk pack that was found for the Cray XMP, which is, I think, the immediate successor to the Cray 1. And there's a nice video there. This part is the Andras part. He's got a emulator running on a modern computer, and is running the Cray XMP software that they recovered. But they're still searching around to try to find the, some remaining data for this, and it has sparked actually some discussion, although it's wandered a bit, on the Classic Computing CC Talk mailing list. So there's been a fair number of people giving suggestions as to who might have a Cray, who might still have these things, and reminiscing about people who had relatives working there and working with Crays and things.
It's
an interesting story, and it is. It might be that this software doesn't exist anymore. I mean, you know, there may be things that are no longer findable too. This is incredibly rare, even when it was current.
Yeah, do you have any idea how many Crays sold? I remember ages ago the thinking was they were only going to sell a handful. That's part of what the price came in. Like, there's going to be 5 or 10 of these. But I did think they sold in the many dozens, like maybe 80 to 100 or so. So, but that's still small potatoes when it comes to, you know, PC numbers. So I guess maybe that's why it's simply unavailable anywhere.
Right, and I actually know very little about the Cray company, so I don't know. I don't know by model. You know, the difference between Cray 1... The Cray 1 is the one that they're specifically looking for, and I don't know, you know, how
so
many.
So you never had a Cray? The rest of us had a Cray.
They're so pretty.
I've still
they're
got
so
one.
Beautiful.
I think Miles had 3.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And Michael's got to have one. I think they give them out in Australia.
Well,
everyone in Australia
actually,
has a Cray.
Actually, I was just thinking that if you got a brand new Mac Pro and a Cray-styled shell, that would give you a great expansion bay underneath it.
They should make a little mini seat that goes around the bottom of the Mac Pro to turn it into a tray. That'd be so amazing.
That new cylindrical Mac Pro, that would be a great idea.
Yeah, that would give you your expansion ports and everything. So all of us who love the case of the cheese grater at the moment, go for something that sort of has a bit of style sitting on your desk and you can still slot bits and pieces in.
That's a fantastic. Oh, you should Kickstarter that like right now, because I think that would actually go even people that don't have one. I love the idea of turning the new Mac Pro into a little mini desktop cray in looks. Oh, fantastic idea. I love it. That's awesome.
And on CC Talk, they were also mentioning this isn't a problem unique to the Cray 1, that a lot of the early machines, even if you could find the hardware and reconstruct it or refurbish it, it's difficult to find those old operating systems and the old software.
Well, very exciting. Great, great first bit of news to kick us off with, Paul. Well done. Well done, you.
Yeah, thank you.
So as always, we'll have links in the show notes. And now we have a really exciting item coming from Miles. This TRS-80 virtual hard drive, which I believe is your own project.
No. I wish, but I...
I think you should be taking credit for the whole thing.
Yeah, no, I wish I could. But no, there are plenty more worthy people than me on this one. But
Let's get them on the show.
Yeah, it has been a number of weeks of toil and journey, and it's been a really fruitful experience going through this. So I thought, well, maybe I can explain a little bit about what it is, because obviously the other personal computers that are probably more commonly spoken about, such as the Apple II, has a very prominent virtualization or virtual disk solution in the CFFA 3000.
Mm-hmm. And there's Commodore ones, I believe, as well, and a number of PCs.
And I'm lucky enough to have a couple of CFFA 3000s here for some Apple IIs as well. So I began from that perspective and then moved. I sort of had this, if I can do this for the Apple, why can't I do this for the TRS-80? And just decided to make that a journey, you know, to try and work it out. So anyway, what happened was I got an old Model 4 TRS-80, which is a machine from, I think it was 1980 or 80-something, 81, 82, something like that.
And I love them. Great form factor in the Model 4.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the interesting thing about the TRS-80 is that it was, if you think in terms of the original trinity of computers that came out in 77, the ones that we consider to be the major players, the Apple II, the TRS-80, and the PET, the TRS-80 was the most was the least expensive of the three. So it was back in the day about half the price of the Apple II in terms of equivalent computer, and about 75% of the price of a Commodore PET. And it came with a monitor, and Radio Shack had this massive distribution network already built. So it was one of those machines that could launch into the personal computing world as an entry-level machine that people who didn't quite even know what a computer was might be able to stretch to afford to buy to learn whether or not this is something they're even interested in. And that machine took hold of that and gained a lot of market share in the very, very low end in the early days. And the reason why this is relevant is that it talks to this hard disk emulator. So I wanted to set at least a little context to begin with this. The problem with the Model 1 TRS-80 when it first came out is it didn't have a floppy disk drive. It was a cassette-based system. And cassettes back in those days were notorious for slow loading and high error rates. You'd probably have a 50% chance of success loading a program off a cassette, and it was frustrating. Mm-hmm. Apple, 12 months later or so, introduced the Disk II and the controller card and reduced the price of their Apple II to the point where an Apple with a disk drive was an affordable experience. Unfortunately, and this is testimony to the genius of Steve Wozniak, in that he built a machine that was openly expandable with a bus architecture, much like a S100 bus was back in the day. And I know he came under a lot of flack for pushing that through as a standard, but it actually really paid off, because Apple could, 12 months later or so, release an inexpensive floppy disk drive upgrade for their machine. Radio Shack at Tandy could not. They had to sell you this massive expansion interface and then these expensive floppy drives that they didn't make, that they were sourcing from third parties. And all of a sudden, you were talking about a very expensive experience to have a Model 1 TRS-80 and a floppy drive as compared with an Apple II and a floppy drive. And it didn't make a lot of sense. So as the personal computer started to get exposure out there in the market, and people came in a year or so later and said, well, what do I want to buy? Do I want to buy this or that? They opted for the Apple II in droves because it was price competitive. It was color, and it had this default floppy drive as its standard storage footprint. So going forward, these computers traditionally never had hard disk drives. Hard drives didn't really become prominent until maybe, I don't know, was it the early 80s when the IBM PC XT really hit? That was one of the first big machines with hard drives in there.
I didn't have a hard drive till the Mac SE. So they were expensive as heck. Hard drives were crazy money.
Yeah, they were. I mean, you know, people who had them, it was kind of a dream that no one, and certainly in the hobbyist and consumer area, you would never be able to fulfill that.
And it's funny too, because it's such a transformative thing. Like having a computer with large amount of storage is fundamentally different than having a computer where you're doing one at a time with floppies. It was one of those big leaps, albeit a very expensive one.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing which is so critical here is to go back in time and think in terms of the fact that a computer without software is nothing. I mean, it's an electronic experience that only those with soldering irons and oscilloscopes would probably enjoy and appreciate. But for the average person, for a personal computer to become available for actual use and to become the industry that we take advantage of today, you would have to have software. It was all about software. The more software you had, the more you got out of the computer. So in the case of storing that software, the media becomes critical. You can't have boxes of cassette tapes and, you know, it's not a platform to go forward from, particularly when you're trying to be more and more serious in your computing. Floppy disk drives were everything. Apple defined floppy disks as the default sort of lowest common denominator software distribution format. So software developers would write software for Apple IIs for floppy disks. They very early on did, but it was very rare that software companies released their software in cassette format for the Apple II after, say, 1980. It was very rare. On the other hand, for the TRS-80, they did release for cassette because it was rare to find people with TRS-80s that had floppy disks. They wanted to go for the lowest common denominator. So having that inexpensive, cheap, early entry computer, such as the Model 1 TRS-80, became a bit of a bugbear for Radio Shack because all the software companies wrote for cassette. So when they tried to produce floppy drives, it was like, well, why do I need this? It's great for storing a lot of stuff, but I'm still buying cassettes. I've still got my cassettes. What do I do? Convert them to disk. And that metaphor followed through into the hard disk. So having said that, we know hard disks were rare back in the day. Floppy disks were very prominent on the Apple II and not so prominent on the TRS-80. Okay, so I'm going to just stop the history lesson at that point and move to current day. So I get this Model 4. And I'm thinking, you know, this would be great, except how do I put my software on this? You know, am I going to be dealing with boxes of floppy disks or, worst case, boxes of cassette tapes to try to make use of this computer? And so, you know, like any interested party, I went to Google and did a search. And lo and behold, there's this guy out of Belgium, I believe, whose name's Fred Verkoven. And Fred had developed a little circuit board. And he had called it the Fred, spelled F-R-E-H-D, which is, I guess, Fred's virtual hard drive. I guess that's how it works. And Fred, if you're listening, please feel free to berate me and tell me off if I've got this wrong. But he produced this circuit, and it was just a circuit board. I mean, it was literally a circuit. You needed to build this. And as we got through 2013, a lot of hobbyists, and strangely, many of them in Australia and New Zealand, had picked up on this circuit and said, you know what, we need to build this as a consumable product. Because what it was is a emulation of a hard disk drive for a TRS-80 Model X. I mean, it works across many models, that uses an SD card as its memory storage. So it would become the hard drive you could never afford to have. And you could have it for pennies. So I succumbed to this and thought, okay, yeah, I'm in. What do I need to do to buy one of these things? So I found that this particular unit was being manufactured by a gentleman out of Melbourne by the name of Ian Maverick.
Oh, that's a good name.
And he had been one of the many people on the team building this product. He had assembled these boards and was selling them, and to this day you can buy them from him. He's got a website, or I'll put it in the show notes with everything else, but he's also on eBay. You can buy it from there as well. And he has this unit, and I thought, this is great. It comes with a boot floppy, and you plug it on the back of your expansion interface on your TRS-80, and instantly you've got masses of storage, more than you'd ever imagine to use. Well, that's interesting, but it's a board, and it doesn't even have a power supply or a case or anything. It's purely for the guy with the soldering iron and the oscilloscope. And I thought, you know, life's too short. At some point, I don't really want to go back in time to that, you know, to having to do that all over again. But, you know, if this is the way to go, I'll buy it. So I did. Shortly before, and maybe the reason why I bought was that Ian had produced a number of videos on YouTube, and again, I'll share the links to all of this for the show notes, showing that with a small little hack modification to the motherboard on a TRS-80, you could have it. So you turned on the computer, and it would boot a custom ROM that would instantly provide a menu of every operating system you had on that SD card on the FRED, and you could just boot to it. And that, yeah, that sung to me. That was like, you know, wow. Because all of a sudden, you can boot CPM, you can boot new DOS 80, LDOS, LSDOS, whatever you had, you could boot it.
And you don't have to swap anything. You're basically just turning it on and selecting what you want then. Oh, nice. That's
exactly
a great feature.
Exactly.
And there were a number of DOSes for the TRS-80 that each have their own charms. So it's nice to be able to choose between them.
Yeah, that was the turning point for me. That's where I started getting it. And at this point, and I always say naively, I was thinking CFFA 3000, when you turn it on, it boots and you choose your disk and what you want to load, that this would be something similar. So I went ahead and got it, and then I ordered this ROM upgrade, and Ian was me, and I thought, this is going to be my holiday project over December. I'll pull this computer apart and go through the whole thing. So I did that, and at the end of the day, it didn't work.
Oh.
Well, the FRED worked, but the auto boot did not work. And thankfully, I didn't brick my TRS-80 in the process. There was no casualties there. But Ian was kind enough to put me in contact with a gentleman from Southern California. His name's Mark, and again, I'll put some of his website links in the show notes as well. He had constructed a custom daughter board for the TRS-80 Model 4 that you would literally take out the ROM chip, plug his board in, put the ROM chip in his board, and then you had a little toggle switch between the original ROM and this custom ROM. And he was kind enough to get one to me, and I plugged it in, and yes, it worked, and there was much rejoicing. At that point, you know, this was great. I turned it on. There's all the operating systems. Boot. FRED's there. I've got masses of storage. Wonderful experience. At this point in time, it was like I was a kid back in the 80s with a TRS-80 with a hard drive. And, man, this was a great experience. But here's where I fell on my face a little bit. I started again thinking that this was like a CFFA. So you would get these disk images, you know, you find them from your own collection or find them on the internet or whatever. You would load them onto this SD card and then you would just boot whatever you had. No, this is a hard disk emulation system, not a floppy disk emulation system, meaning that you still boot the system as if it was booting from a floppy, and the hard disk is just this mass storage unit that you've got attached to the back of the computer. You don't boot the hard disk in the same way that you boot floppies on the Apple II. It took me a while to get that in my head, to work that out. And then I think this is just a question of evolution, because I think this is an awesome product that they've done with the Fred, and it's going in the right direction. But unlike the CFFA, which comes with its own utilities in ROM to be able to convert your disks to images and so on, you don't have quite the level of access with the Fred that you would have with the CFFA. And so consequently, you end up using things like a Windows-based PC running an emulator to copy things out of disk images and into hard disk images, and then copy the hard disk image to the SD card, and it's a lot of work.
But those should eventually just be, no doubt, made available. For the Apple II world, for instance, there's lots of sources for me to go and download a pre-configured hard drive that has an OS on it, tons of software, there's like sort of starter kits. I'm sure those same images will start to become available for this.
Yes, I totally agree. And in fact, if you were to look at the last 12 months of evolution of this product, it's been rapid changes. I mean, they've been doing things like rolling out versions of this product every couple of weeks to add support for the Model 3, the Model 1, the Model 4P. I mean, they've done this remarkable fast migration. I even was reading the other day, they've got a Fred now for the K-Pro. So you can use it. Yeah, you can use it as a hard drive for a K-Pro computer. So this is a train that's shooting down the tracks right now. And if there is anything that would be an obstacle that would, you know, make it difficult, it's going to get sorted out. So I think at this point, if you are a TRS-80 owner and you don't have one of these, there's really no excuse not to have one. You really should get one. But the world's going to look continuously better afterwards. And I don't think that's going to mean that you buy something that becomes redundant. They do firmware upgrades and software.
So I have a couple of questions then. So first of all, what are we looking at price-wise for, say, one of these kits?
I think mine cost me $250.
Okay, so it's right in line with similar solutions for other PCs then.
Yeah. There are a few things you need. You need to have like a hard expansion cable for it, so you may have to pay a little extra for that.
Right, and just to get the little bits. But I just want to see, like, is this a $1,000 thing? Or is it, so now, is there any issue with the software itself? Like, I know for a number of different PCs, they'll have different versions of the operating system, and sometimes you can't just take a piece of software and stick it on a hard drive. It won't run. Like, it needs something particular about the floppies that were coming on. Is that the case for the TRS-80 world? Are there issues with taking the software that was designed for cassette, say, or for floppy eventually, and putting it on the hard drive? Do most things actually run?
Well, yes, they do. If you've got the ability to go back in time and remember the world as it looked like from Radio Shack's eyes back in the 80s. They had many models of computers, many versions of operating systems, and things were not necessarily compatible. For example, the Model 1 to the Model 3 was generally compatible, but there were exceptions. The Model 3 to the Model 4 was compatible if you booted the Model 3 operating system on the Model 4. The Model 4 had an 80-column display, for example, the Model 3 a 64. So software that was designed for one had to be run under certain conditions on the other in order for it to work. The journey in making this work in a sort of simplified, generic world is not as simple as it is in the Apple ecosystem, where Apple controlled a lot of that. Radio Shack did floppy drives, for example, came in all varieties of sizes and shapes. You had single-sided, single-density, double-density drives. I think there were 40 tracks, 80 tracks. There were different manufacturers. There was a world of difference out there.
The TRS-80 guys are a bunch of savages.
Yeah, it wasn't as consumer friendly as they probably would have liked it to be. Let's put it that way.
I know that one of the problems that Apple, you know, faces with moving things to the hard drive is copy protection. I mean, I think where sometimes for efficiency things would directly access the disk II, you know, the specific Apple II drive, but people just didn't want you to be able to copy it, so they would check to make sure that you're running off the floppy, and that's I think been often the thing that's sort of blockaded putting things on on, you know, sort of simulated hard drives or actual hard drives on an Apple too. How was copy protection in the TRS-80 world?
Well, you did have very similar copy protection. There were copy protected boot disks that you required if you were in the floppy disk system. But again, because a lot of the software companies back then went for the lowest common denominator, which would have been cassette tape, their ability to copy protect was severely limited compared to the Apple world. Mm-hmm. So you would find that programs would be just an executable bunch of binary data as opposed to a complete disk image you had to boot in a certain way. It was cut with holes in certain places on the magnetic media or whatever. This was not like that. You can just copy a file over this thing and typically it runs.
Well, this is very exciting. This whole Fred thing is new to me. And I think this is a remarkably exciting development. Like, this is just fantastic. So we'll make sure we have links to everything in the show notes for people who are interested, or even people like me who think this might actually just, I like the challenge of this, and the opportunity might drag me into the TRS-80 world. This seems really, really cool. Nice, nice contribution, Miles. Well done, you.
Oh, thank you.
Way to step up. And Earl. And next, we turn our attention to you and away from the TRS-80 just momentarily to see the battle between the Apple II and the Commodore 64. A mighty battle with a happy ending is, I believe, the way the press are talking about it. So why don't you tell us about you and I fighting mighty chess battle yesterday?
Yes, that is the way that I saw it mentioned in the New York Times today, the online edition. So I challenged Carrington to a game of chess, Commodore 64 versus Apple II. And it's because Carrington had roundly disparaged the Commodore, and I felt like its honor was at stake. And unfortunately, I'll skip to the end, I didn't succeed in defending the honor of the Commodore 64, but we had a lot of fun in the process. First off, we had to work out the technology of how to connect our real computers, because we didn't want to play this on an emulator, to the video, to some sort of video capture solution, so that we could bring it up on a Google Hangout for the world to see on YouTube mm-hmm. Live. And we did that. We did it using a couple different technologies, but it worked. So the day came. It was yesterday. We streamed it live. We got on there and lit up our chess programs and began to do battle. And I actually found the battle between the two chess programs. It was Colossus Chess on the Apple II and Cyrus II on the Commodore 64. And I thought it was just a world of fun. Not only did we have a lot of viewers whose comments made the whole thing more fun, but watching the style of play was fascinating. So I'll go quick here, but here's the way it happened. The two programs faced off pretty conservatively at first. In the beginning, using some rather standard openings and not being very aggressive. In the middle game, though, all of a sudden, all carnage broke loose. And the Apple II shed first blood. It took, was it a pawn that you took?
It was, yes, I think just a pawn. But then I got that taste for blood, and my software just wanted to swap pieces every chance it could.
Right. So all of a sudden, before we knew it, in the middle game, all of the heavy artillery was consigned to the recycle bin. And we were dealing with just a couple of bit pieces and pawns and a couple of kings sitting out there going, whoa. So we got to the end game. And at this point, Cyrus II makes a boneheaded move that, if you go back and watch the video, which we'll have a link to the YouTube if you want to go see it, and it just left me scratching my head. And the result of this move was one of Carrington's pawns made it clear across the field and became a queen.
And it was funny because we sort of anticipated, we looked at it and said, well, it's funny how my software seems to be trying to bait you into taking my rook, but if you go do that, my pawn will suddenly be behind everybody, and I could make a run for a queen. And then your software took the bait. You went for my rook, and I got a queen out of it.
Right.
It was awesome.
Now,
it was awesome.
So I don't think that was all that awesome. So here's a fascinating part of this. Cyrus II was taking longer to think than Colossus Chess. And usually with a chess program, the longer it takes to think, all other things being equal, the better move it's going to make, because it's going through permutations, figuring out what is the best bet. But Cyrus II did this boneheaded thing. And after the game, Carrington and I were talking. It turns out Colossus Chess has a feature that Cyrus II does not.
It's a good feature.
It's a good feature. It was talked about on this chess enthusiast site that where both of us found information on. Cyrus II went into this being the favorite because in past matches of comparable computers, it had basically cleaned their clocks.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and it beat all the equivalent software on the C64, but also on other computers. Like, it was sort of the what seemed to be the reigning champion from back in the day.
But if you look at this chess enthusiast site, this computer chess site, you'll see Cyrus II has a shortcoming. When it's sitting there waiting, it's not thinking. It's not going through possible future permutations. It's just idling, waiting for you to type in your move, after which it begins to think. Colossus Chess, on the other hand, is proactive. While it's waiting for the user to enter the move, it is trying to figure out the most likely move the user will make and then coming up with responses to that move. So it's just pondering, not wasting that CPU time while it's waiting for input. And I honestly think that's what made the difference between the two programs. I think Colossus Chess and that proactive mode enabled it to see, hey, I think I'll sneak a pawn across the board. Whereas Cyrus II kind of scratched its head and, you know, saw a squirrel and went after the squirrel and in the meantime missed the bear that was coming at it from...
Because we had both agreed we set the levels of the software to sort of limit how long they would spend. I think we set like a 2-minute limit. The software never seemed to want to take that full 2 minutes, but we had not just said, like for Colossus 4 I was using, I think it was, it does have a mode to say you have an infinite amount of time. Just keep thinking and thinking and thinking through every possible permutation. And that's for if you're playing by mail, for instance, and you can say, I'm just let it run overnight, let it run over the weekend. And at any point you can just say go and it'll give you the move it has decided is the best in looking forward. I had set it to say, no, you get a maximum of 2 minutes. But then you're right, it'll say, okay, I'll use 2 minutes of my time, but I'll use all the time I can of my opponent's time as well. So frequently, your software would move, mine would move immediately, and then we'd have to wait while you were thinking. So it just looked like my software was going crazy fast. We couldn't really figure out why my software was so quick. It was awesome.
Yes. Yeah, that was really cool. And we learned some stuff. We had a great time. We had about 30 live viewers. And I noticed this morning the video has had 200 views. So lots of folks out there taking a look at this epic chess battle between the Apple II and the Commodore 64. And we've decided we had so much fun doing this and figuring out the technology. We're going to do other battles, possibly with other computers, other software, other types of games, not just chess. We'll do backgammon, we'll do board games, we'll do card games, we'll just, and we'll let you know when we're going to do
Apple
these
II
things.
Host a Dungeons & Dragons game.
Yeah,
kill you all off. It was super fun, and you're right, one of the things that was fun about it was figuring out how to get Google Hangouts to see an external vintage computer, because Google Hangout does not like to look at things that are not webcams. So I think maybe what we'll try to do is maybe put in the show notes, we can each put in the chain of software we had to use, because other people might want to do something like this. And now that we figured it out, it's actually easy to enable, but it was tricky. I tried a lot of different options, and I only found one that would work to get an Apple II to show clearly and not reversed on a current Mac and be seen by Google. So now we've come up with that solution. I'd like to make sure that other people can do it as well. I'm happy that we did it as not just us playing, but that we recorded the video, because it's particularly because the Apple II won, but mostly because I think it's a nice thing to just have out there. We're following up on last year that software computer or the movie Computer Chess came out, so it's sort of fun to do our own version. But I'm very happy that it's been recorded for posterity now and can be out there with our trash talking enabled.
Completely agreed. It was a lot of fun. And so if you've got some time to spare, you ought to go take a look at it.
Absolutely.
And we'll do more.
So, Paul, you are up next. The Retro UK Cinema Fest has a couple of words in it that I like. I like the word cinema. I like the word retro. I like the UK. And I enjoy a fest. So what is this?
Well, it's basically just me writing down a couple of things that I sort of happened across recently. So sat down and watched a few videos of what sparked this is actually something that will be mentioned later about the anniversary of the Sinclair QL. But there was a mention in there, there was a photo in there from a movie called Microman, which I think was actually mentioned on this podcast like a year and a half ago, but I finally watched it, and it's the story basically of the early Sinclair and the rivalry between Sinclair and Acorn to get the contract to make the BBC Micro, and it's really interesting actually, and well done. It's from 2009, so it's not new. It features many people you know. Peter Davison is in there as a banker, and what is his name? No, I've forgotten, but the guy who plays Watson on
Peter
the
Davison?
Current...
Wait a minute, Peter Davison, the doctor?
The doctor. He's a banker.
Fantastic.
Suggesting that this computer idea is a little science fiction-y.
Not my favorite doctor, but I kind of like them all, so.
Martin Freeman is the head, the Acorn guy. But at any rate, it was very interesting, and I sort of went down a rabbit hole on the BBC Micro and found a couple of other things. There's a I think it's a podcast website, something called Computer File, that did a couple of YouTube videos on relatively recent on the BBC Micro. Came across a movie called Podfather, another BBC 2009 production about the creation of the integrated circuit, and also came across there's a forthcoming documentary called From Bedrooms to Billions, which is about the video game industry starting up in the UK. So I find this sort of interesting just because I was pretty much up till now very US-centric, North American-centric. I knew almost nothing about what happened off the coasts. So
that makes you so different from most Americans.
One has to
be. Now.
However, what's interesting is looking at some of these things, you know, clearly there were very sort of things that had very large effects that were sort of still sort of contained within the UK that didn't make it across, you know, that I knew very little about most of these things. I may have mentioned before that I actually had for that was probably a month or two, North American BBC Micro to play with. But as I recall, I didn't have anything to save with, you know, so it was all sort of, you know, let's see what I can make this thing do, but nothing is permanent once I turn it off. So anyway, that's all. I have nothing more to say other than there's a list of links of things that I found interesting.
But all of which is very interesting, particularly the Microman. I'd like to watch that. So I'll make sure we have a link
great.
To that in the show notes.
The John Sands Sega SC-3000, named by Video Age as the best home computer of 1983. And if you buy now, its price of less than $300 also includes this Sega Super Tape of six great programs, plus a five-hour hands-on course in using your Sega.
These extras alone are worth more than $200.
All this, the best home computer of 1983, the Sega Super Tape, the free five-hour computer course, all for less than $300 at these stores now. Hurry, while stocks last.
So, Earl, I want to give something away. We've got so many people on the show today. I feel excited. I think it's time for us to give somebody something. Do you have anything we can give away other than Paul's brain?
Well, we can't give away Paul's brain? Fine. Oh. Then I suggest we give away a copy of Sophistication and Simplicity, that wondrous book on Apple II history written by our own Dr. Steve. And we've actually had 15 people write in with answers to the various questions that we ask on our book contest.
They answered the quiz, the multiple question quiz we put in front of them.
They did. At first it worried me because we only had one or two, but then they really started to roll in. So here's the way this works. I'm on random.org. It is a website that has services to give you true randomness.
No such thing.
I'm going to pick you can use, what do they call it? Bias correction, or
I will not be bias corrected. You cannot make me. You Commodore users are always trying to do that.
So here's the deal. I'm going to pick a random number between 1 and 15. Actually, I'm not. Random.org is. The number is nine. One.
It's one.
It's the number one.
I like the number nine better.
I like the number one.
I won't give the name. I will just read the answers. If the answers are correct, then I will give the name. How's that?
What if nobody got any of the answers correct?
Then I think we're in big trouble. So the answer to question one is Apple II Revision Zero board. I believe that is correct.
Yes, that is something else that Apple shipped as a bare motherboard, which is the Apple II. Or the Apple I.
The answer to number two, encoded bytes that when decoded spell Microsoft backwards.
Also correct. Yes, that was what secret code did Microsoft embed in the Apple II Plus, and they encoded their name in a way that you couldn't see it through ASCII. You had to decode it.
In fact, it number also three, ends on an exclamation point.
That's correct. Yes. Yep. Well put. Yes.
And that's actually in the answer here.
Ooh, good answer so far.
Number three, the answer is six. Six colors.
Yep. How many high-res colors could an original Apple II display? I agree. It's six. There was some rules on what you could put beside other things, get the weird fringing and stuff, but that is correct.
And number four, 8 megabytes.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
8 megabytes.
8 megabytes is correct answer, too. That's the maximum amount of RAM that was supported by the Apple in the Apple IIgs.
Yes!
And 8 was the max. Nice. Now, did this person answer the bonus question, too?
He did, and he got it wrong.
Oh.
However, that doesn't matter.
Does not matter.
It doesn't matter, because he got the first four right.
But, Earl, what is the answer to the bonus question?
The answer that he gave is, returns a check disk drive error, which is not correct. It would boot the external drive.
Yeah, it would boot the Apple. I think it boots the Apple IIc.
The later model, the later models of the IIcs, they'll have that error.
Ah.
Right.
But in any case, questions 1 through 4 were correct. So, Ben, I will get back to you, and we will be sending you a copy of Sophistication and Simplicity. Congratulations! Yay! Everybody cheer with me. Yay!
Yay! Congratulations, Ben.
I mean, yay.
Hurrah.
Back over to you. And Kirchin, back to you.
With the weather. Speaking of books, David, you guys remember David. David used to be on the show, and then we kicked him off. Maybe that's not really what happened. Hello, David. David, no. David's awesome. And, of course, he also has a book, and he has, I believe, sold out of all his complete historically brewed books, the printed copies. And so to sort of celebrate, he is having a sale right now on the PDF copy. So we said we would mention that on the show as well. So it's been reduced down to just $3.99. So if you want to get the PDF ebook, you can get it directly from him. We'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. So the complete historically brewed for the cheap price of just under $4 American. And then the last bit of news before we move on is just a little note that, and I'm only bringing this up really quick just because it's an upcoming event. There's the Mac 30th is coming up, and it's basically an event to celebrate 30 years of the Macintosh, of course, from 1984 to now 2004. It's going to take place on January 25th at the Flint Center in presumably Flint, Michigan. You think I would know this if I'm the guy bringing the news? But I don't know. We'll have a link in the show notes. But if you want to get together with other people and celebrate that little toaster-shaped computer, then you can do so. It's on January 25th, so it'll be before our next show, and maybe we can get a write-up or somebody who goes there could send us some information about the event if they go and take it over. And I'm sure we will have coming forward throughout the year lots of different 30th anniversaries, because 1984 was one of the big years for computers, and so all of those are going to turn 30 this year.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm excited.
I can tell the excitement. So now it is time. We've given things away, and now it's time to buy things. In particular, buy things for me. And rather than selecting a host gift this time, which is an item you can buy me, I'm going to let you all just buy me gifts on your own and just, you know, use your best judgment. More is generally better. And I'm going to instead suggest and pick as my retro computing gift idea what you can wrap your gift in. And over on Zazzle, there is retro computer wrapping paper. So if you've got a retro computer enthusiast and you're giving them a gift and you're looking for the perfect way to wrap it up, then there's a couple of options for just actual present wrapping paper that is all printed with vintage computers on it. So that is going to be my choice for this show. I'm going to add that to our ongoing and growing list of retro computing gift suggestions over on our gift guide, which you can find at rcrpodcast.com/gift guide. Now, What sort of things might somebody purchase that they could then give to somebody wrapped up in that wonderful paper? So let's turn our attention now to the eBay auction choices, if we have them. Earl, why don't we kick it off with you? What have you got for us?
Well, first off, I think we should buy you an Atari 800 because now you've finally come out and admitted that you want one. So
I do want one. I do. I've had a few people text me and with offers and with suggestions, so I might actually snap one soon.
For me, we had this conversation, I don't remember, was it last time, that if you could have a retro clone of your computer, would you like it just as much as if it were the real thing?
That was last time's
and
host topic.
So
yes.
Here's one option if you're the type who would like to have a clone. This is a clone of either an Amiga or an Atari ST, one of those wondrous 68,000-based machines. It uses field programmable gate array technology, FPGA. And so down in the gates and the hardware, it's actually emulating one of those computer systems. You can get it for about US$312. And then for me, it would be about $20 shipping. And it's this is from Great Britain, I believe, because the price is in GBP. And if I scoot down here and take a look, I can see different pictures of the FPGA development board, but also then they've put it in a case. So the case is kind of nondescript, actually. There's not a lot of logos on it and things like that. I suppose that's an opportunity for you to put your own decorations on it if you want to. But if you want to run something like an Atari or an Amiga like you would have run it back in the day, you can do it with this box. It's, how can I say this? It's kind of a software emulation, but not really. FPGA is kind of emulating or implementing logic down at a gate level rather than at a code level.
I like FPGAs, although it always seems to be every FPGA computer sort of like, I want to have a computer, but I want to buy it now and I'll decide what computer I want later. It's for people that really can't make decisions.
Well, and again, with this one, you could have either an Atari or an Amiga, so I guess that's true, right? And they've even got a nice video here of the Atari operating system booting up. So that's my pick.
And what are we looking at price-wise for that? What's the starting bid?
I think this is a buy it now. Let me scoot it back up there and see. It's a buy it now. And it is Great British Pounds, £189.99, which in U.S. is $312.44.
Kind of pricey.
A little bit on the pricey side,
right?
You
can pick up an Amiga and an Atari for less than, that's about $300 Canadian, which is real money.
Yes, we measure everything in loonies.
Nice. So good choice. I like it. So it looks like next up is Paul. Paul, what have you got to compete with that? How can you better Earl's choice?
Well, I seem for some reason to be very sort of fixated on these little calculator computers. But the particular auction that I am looking at is a TRS-80 pocket computer set. And the thing that actually makes this one interesting is just all the stuff that comes with it. It's got cassettes, it's got the boxes, it has the printer interface. I think it is. Well, it's at least the cassette interface, but I think it has a printer too. All the manuals. It looks really nice, and its starting bid is only $40. So it's
nice.
It's not insane. I suspect that it's going to go higher than that. But it also brings up another thing, which is that if you look, well, a couple of other things, if you look at it, there's a picture of it, and it clearly in the LCD has a bunch of bleeding. You know, the display has whatever happens to LCD displays has happened to this one. And so this is a nice set, but you might want to replace the actual machine. And it's also the same machine as the Sharp PC-1211. The Sharp made these for Radio Shack at the time. So presumably if you can find one of those, which actually isn't so easy, you could take the display out of that one and put it in this one. But I really like the boxes. I really like the manuals. It's a very complete set. And also I noticed, if I'm not wrong about this, if you go to Wikipedia and look at the TRS-80 pocket computer, one page, there's a picture. And the picture is of this very computer, I think. Just judging by the bleed pattern, I think it is the actual one pictured on Wikipedia.
Oh, that's interesting. So I guess this owner is the person who submitted the photo.
I guess.
That's very cool.
I should say, looking at these a little bit, so this is a risk with these things. I think a lot of them have. If you're searching for them, you find that a lot of them say they have display problems. One of the things that's fortunate about these is that you, I think, can tell even when it's powered off if there's a problem. So even if it's not untested, if you do want to look at the picture and you want to make sure that you don't see this pattern, or at least unless you want it for some reason.
It's interesting. I've got a bunch of these guys, and I don't have any of them with bleedy LCDs. I wonder what causes some to do this and not others.
And maybe of this particular model, or is it? I wonder if it's a some sort of manufacturing defect of this one.
Cool. I like it. I like your choice. But I was looking at the Wikipedia article, and unless they all have that same bleeding problem with the same format, this one does seem to have exactly the dark parts that's on Wikipedia. So I agree. It looks like an exact match. I think this is the famous Wikipedia one. Well, that's got to be worth a few extra dollars just
right
there.
I'm sure, right?
I like it. Nice. And well spotted you. Like, wow, that's crazy. You're like a little detective. Nice. So for my choice, I'm going for cables. I'm not even making a choice. I'm picking things in general. There's a reseller, Digi4D. I think the 4D stands for discount. So Digi4Discount over in Bulgaria. And this is a seller that's been selling hardware and making things. Does that A2 split, the thing that splits out 3.5 and 5.25, it's like a little adapter that splits them out for the Apple II. And I purchased once from this reseller before and had a very good experience with a little SD card reader that's kind of like a stripped down CFFA 3000. And so it's an SD card reader that emulates floppies, even simpler than a CFFA. And I really liked it. It was a good experience, quick shipping. So it's a reseller I can recommend. And it seems that this person has gone bonkers on cables. And sometimes with old computers, it's difficult to find cables. So they seem to be now manufacturing cables. Tons and tons and tons of different sorts of cables. Serial cables, parallel cables, monitor cables for vintage Apple IIs. The 2C, the 2Es, the 2GS, the whole lot. So if you find yourself searching for a cable or a crimp connector or something like that, there seems to be a new source in town, and by in town I mean Bulgaria, but there's a new source in the world for such things, all bagged up, all new, seems to be freshly made and with a warranty on them. So it's a good new source. Can be a little pricey. Some cables are running up to like $30 for them, but most of them are in the low teens or just, you know, $5 to $7. So seems very reasonable, and I have experience with the seller, although no relationship with them. So just wanted to bring it to everybody's attention that there is a new source for Apple II cables, and so that's going to be my pick for my auction choice. And what about you, Miles, with your accent? what are you bringing to the table?
Well, this—I don't know if I call this an eBay auction pick or a mission of mercy, but there's a link we're posting here. I guess it's an eBay auction for somebody who lives in Austin, Minnesota, which I believe at the time of recording this podcast would be freezing cold right now. And what they have—I've been following this for, I guess it must be about 3 months. It just has not been sold. They have a collection of vintage computer parts and mainly Macintosh, but in looking at their photos, there's IBM PC monitors and everything. But we're talking thousands of computers and monitors and keyboards. And the photos, it looks like these are in an old barn or something, and they've got parts of them stuck in somebody's Airstream trailer out the back. And it looks like some huge CompUSA must have gone out of business and this guy inherited everything in 1987. And it's amazing the condition of this stuff. The problem is that it's in an environment which appears to be subject to flooding, every sort of natural disaster you could imagine. And the photographs that they've posted on this auction are in 2008. So they're fairly old. Obviously, this person has had this collection, and I use the term, you know, I think in terms of collection of somebody who has 5 or 10 things, not somebody who has 5,000. And in this particular case, we're closer to the 5,000 mark here. There are so many computers of all types of varieties, Macs, IBM PS2s, IBM PCs, Apple IIs, Apple IIGSs, Duo disk drives. I mean, I could go on and on. It wouldn't stop. There's so much stuff up there. And so I would put a message out there to the community that if anybody ever wanted to restore a lot of computers, please do it with this guy on eBay, because this stuff is just getting damaged because it's not getting picked up, and it would be history lost if this guy goes through another one of these flooding exercises, I think.
The photos are heartbreaking. You look at this stuff just piled up and palletized and looks like thrown around and just, it's just terrible. And so many vintage computers here.
Yeah, I feel like Sarah McLachlan with one of those dogs on television, you know, where I want to go out
please,
and say, please rescue. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I believe that this is the result of a couple of school salvages. This auction in various forms has been there for probably a year and a half or something. I once actually did talk to the guy who has this, and this is not his specialty. You know, he basically told, you know, a friend of his, he will get rid of it, but there is just an unbelievable amount of stuff there. You look at it and your energy drains.
Well, also the photos are all date stamped 2008. So this stuff has been there for 5 more years. So God knows what's happened to it now, and they don't even do new photos. So it's scary, but there's so much stuff, and a tractor for some reason. Just piled up. Oh my goodness.
Maybe the tractor is for hauling off the computers.
Maybe. It seems to be stored, part of it inside some sort of trailer and part inside some sort of barn, maybe. It's hard to tell from the photos, but yeah, quite heartbreaking to look at them. My goodness. Okay, now that you've broken our heart, Miles, we'll move on to Michael, who hopefully will bring us back up with something fun. Michael, what have you got to round out our eBay auction choices?
Well, today's choice is basically for people who want to sneak something small into the house. Well, basically, that's my situation. This is an iClock, so you have a small digital clock styled in the iMac. So in my situation, I could buy this, sneak it into the house, and my wife wouldn't even notice it.
It looks just like the old IMAX, like the original IMAX.
Yeah, similar to the original Bondi Blue, but somewhat smaller and probably a lot less CPU.
Probably, yes. Almost certainly. What a tiny little clock.
Yeah, I've got a few similar sorts of iMac and Mac-styled clocks, but this one looks to be an interesting one, and it's local for us Australians. So someone here, go get it.
Yeah, only $2.25 at the moment, so also not a very pricey item. And it's interesting because it's a reminder what an impact on industrial design that iMac was. It was such a departure from the way computers looked, and suddenly there were lots of things, rival PCs and just lots of items in general that were going for that shape, for that plasticky look, for the little stripy white plastic on the front of it. So there was this period where this kind of thing was everywhere.
And just on one closing note on this one, I think it's a little bit of revenge for eBay in the US. I don't think they actually ship to the US.
Ha! That'll show them. Oh, it doesn't ship to Canada either. That'll show me.
But if you want it, Carrington, I'll get it to you.
Excellent. I appreciate that. And then I guess just to finish off, Earl had selected last time a ZX80 with a very low price point, and we said we would come back and look at what it sold for, and it did indeed sell for $317.99, so it got bid up quite a bit, 18 bids on that, and it did finally sell to somewhere.
And I have to admit, that's less than I thought it was going to go for.
I would have predicted $400 or $500, yeah.
That is in the when you're talking $300 US, you're in the this is a popular and somewhat rare computer, but not super rare, like an MSI or an Altair or something else that's going to go for a lot more money than that. I actually expected about what you did, Carrington. So somebody got a deal on this, which is great.
Yeah. So well done then. So I think we'll just wrap up things now. The only thing I have to contribute for closing is a neat little link over at technobob.com with an 8-bit harmonica. So somebody's built a harmonica into a Nintendo cartridge-looking shell. You know how you used to have to blow on the cartridges? Well, now you can blow on the cartridges, and it makes noise. And I found it wonderful. So I'm going to have a link to that in the show notes. But does anybody else have anything to contribute? Michael, I think you've got something about the winter warm-up to wrap us up
with. Yes. Well, last week you were asking if anyone apart from Earl was going into the winter warm-up, and I've decided that I'd take my S-Basic program that I typed into my Apple II back in 1983-84, and it's a preprocessor, so you use a full-screen text word processor to do your program code, sans line numbers, and then it would go through and tokenize the output to produce a AppleSoft program. It supported GoTo, GoSubs by label. Added,
oh, nice.
It added what I liked, if-then-else. The original AppleSoft was only a if-then, and this allows you to have multiple nested if statements. Looping structures, loop, end loop, repeat until. And so I'm taking that program and retyping it as an S-Basic program itself so that I can then take that text file, run it through the original S-Basic program so that it actually generates itself.
Nice. Very nice. Very good. That's a great choice for projects.
And to just to top it off, if I've got time, I want to pass arguments in the GoSub so that you would have GoSub label and then open brackets, list of arguments.
Oh, so you're basically going to have full functions then. That's nice. Yeah.
So we'll see how we go. I must admit, moving house has kind of crimped on my programming time. But I'll be documenting all this on my blog for the winter warm-up, which is a very strange name for doing this down here in Sydney, because it definitely isn't winter and it's gone way past warming up.
Right. There's 40 degrees or so for you.
Oh, so, 42 the other day. That's about, what, 105, 107 for Fahrenheiters?
So technically, if it's a winter warm-up, you get an extra 6 months to finish, is what they're saying.
If it's a winter warm-up, I might get an extra 10 degrees head start.
That's true. So nicely done. That's really interesting. So we'll make sure we have a link to that in the show notes as well. I'm very interested in your project, so I will be following that. That is nice.
Oh, you may lurk.
I will. I shall lurk. So that wraps us up. A little longer show than usual, but there were more people and more accents, and we felt very global today, so that was wonderful. Thanks, everyone, for joining in the show, and thanks to everyone for listening. You can find the show notes for all our shows, obviously, at our host, which is rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums. That's vintage-computer.com/VC forum. That's a lot to remember, so it's easier to remember to just go to rcrpodcast.com and click on the old link to the forum. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at rcrpodcast. You can kind of see a trend here. Send us feedback. That feedback goes to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, and Earl gets it. Earl reads it, and Earl decides what we get to see. So if you don't get a reply, you know who to blame. We are a member of the Throwback Network, so if you like our kind of show, you can find more like us over there at throwbacknetwork.net. Cool place to hang out. Please, Earl begs you to write a review of us on iTunes. It helps people find us. And otherwise, we're kicking Earl off the show. So
write it right now. Go now.
Right now. If you want Earl to stay on the show, you better write a good review on iTunes. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We really appreciate you tuning in and listening to the show. We love your feedback and interaction. Look forward to talking to you in 2 weeks. And until next time, as they say,
Retro compute.
See, only one person did it. Bye, everyone.
Bye.